mentioned OSPF and ISIS, which are two internal routing protocols. Of course, we started with the famous RIP as an internal routing protocol. Then OSPF and IS, people are now using Border Gateway Protocol as an internal protocol. We have RIP2 coming down the pike.
Right.
Do we have too many routing protocols? Should we say no? Is it good to have so many?
I don't know. I find RIP actually is a great host discovery protocol, or router discovery protocol. You can use it. Basically, routers send out RIP default, and hosts, most hosts that are shipped from vendors are equipped with a route D that they can run in minus Q mode and basically just quiet mode, and they just pick up routes from routers, and that way they know they can host can figure out where their default gateway is, and then they can be ICMP redirected.
So it's good for a workstation.
So I think it's good for certain sets of things there. I think there's also the case that a lot of situations, if you have three or four Ethernets, you know, do you really need something more complicated? Especially if you've got low-cost routers, people are building Ethernet routers, PC-based platforms that go Ethernet to Ethernet, very cheap. You have a lot of companies getting into low-end router business these days. And so there's a lot of topologies that I think that you don't – static routing would work fine in, okay? And so RIP is just an easier way of doing it than static routing. But once – I think we've learned in the past that networks tend to get very complicated. They grow. They're not a static thing. And as networks get larger and larger, you need to move up to something that has very a more capable protocol. OSPF, I think, has been proven in the marketplace as a good protocol. It's being used all over the world. It's being used in some very large networks. And one of the things that we put into it when it was being designed was this notion of classless routing. Everything is a sort of a route plus a mask. There's not A, B, or C that's hard-coded into that. That has proven with CIDR and some of the future activities that people are trying to put in place now for sort of restructuring the way routing in the Internet works to be a very good decision. And so I think you may use OSPF in places where the complexity isn't driving you, but just the way you want to do your subnetting or sort of route masking and matching works.
Now, I know some networks, EBONE, the European backbone, for example, mm-hmm. instead of using OSPF internally, appears that they're going to be using BGP internally,
right.
IBGP.
Right.
Why would you want to use IBGP or OSPF? Is there room for both of them as an internal routing protocol?
I don't, you know, if you're basically, in the transit net business, you don't have really very many internal routes, okay? If you look at the NSN backbone, for example, how many routers and how many router-to-router interconnects are there? There are not that many. Most of the routes that are passed are external routes. You can pass external routes by importing them into an internal gateway protocol like OSPF and then re-exporting them out at the other end, or you can pass them in essence via an external protocol that's running through your internal network. That's the difference. OSPF can carry external information. It can carry a certain amount of information, a tag field that goes with it, and that allows you to make policy determinations when you import it and export it. You can do the same thing with IBGP. I think the way that IBGP works, with its primarily sort of point-to-point orientation, and in certain circumstances, that works quite well, and it avoids having all that information be passed in your insides. If you've got a router, if you've got a very simple network topology internally, and you're carrying a lot of external information, then why bother the internal protocols with carrying all kinds of information where it's just basically acting as sort of a transport for it, just passing it from one place to the other. It's not really acting on it internally. Effectively. On the other hand, if you've got a complex internal structure like NSI does, the way a lot of regional networks do, there are some definite advantages by importing that, and especially if you've got a very wide range of interfaces, you may not be able to effectively do point-to-point IBGP connectivity.
What about ISIS? When would I want to run that?
Well, I think right now there's just not enough ISIS implementations out that people really want to use that. I think if you're in an IP-only environment, I think you're probably still better off using OSPF, which was really designed and optimized to deal with things the way IP does them. ISIS is a very capable protocol, but I think most of the proponents of ISIS argue that that you should use it in sort of this integrated routing model where you have both IP and OSI being carried in a single routing protocol or other protocols as well. And we just don't have enough vendors who are doing that or enough customers who are actually doing that right now to say whether it's successful or not. I just all the successful multi-protocol router vendors so far have implemented multiple protocols using multiple stacks. They have not done it the integrated way. There's some, in certain situations, there's advantages to doing it in an integrated way. In other situations, it's not. The marketplace is basically going to decide that. You know, it's that's the great thing about the internet, right? You can actually validate your design principles by whether or not it's successful at meeting real-world problems that real-world people have. And it's not just theory. It's not just
well, gross revenue that. Speaks the world, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure, certainly does. It certainly does.
I've heard of you, and I'm not sure how many people share it, which is that all this work on complex, scalable routing protocols is a waste of time, and the reason is because we're moving to a global ATM cloud around the world, and you don't really need routing protocols. Everyone will be able to speak to everyone else directly.
Well, you know, that's an interesting view, and it's held by a lot of people who I have a lot of respect for. The problem is that you're always going to have conventional LANs out there. There's Ethernets that are out there. Ethernet is not going to go away, not when you can get adapters for, you know, $50, $60 in essence of parts. You know, you put them in, and they're built into workstations. 10BASE-T and all of that at operating at 10 megabits, there's a lot of conventional networking technology that's out there. And there are low-speed lines. You know, I've heard some people talk about putting ATM over T1 or even something like 56kbit, but really, you know, you pay a lot of overhead when you're trying to run on top of a small line that you're trying to get the maximum amount of data across.
Well, as we've learned with TCP over dial-up lines.
For example. And so,
and header compression for ATM, I guess, is not being considered yet.
there are different ways you could compress. You know, there are pluses and minuses of that. I think, you know, the question is really, you know, ATM is not a perfect technology, and I don't think any of its proponents are arguing that. It solves a certain set of problems, and it's a standard that a lot of people have embraced, and it gives you certain functionality that it's very good to get that way. The resource control and some of the other capabilities are great, isochronous transport. But as long as you have disparate networks, you need an internet protocol. Okay. Now, if you're going Ethernet to ATM, how are you going to do that? Are you going to do that by pushing some MAC layer stuff, and then what application stack? TCP/IP is you've got TCP as transport, but that's designed to run on top of IP. You can't run TCP on top of 802.2 right now. I don't know anybody who's proposing doing that kind of thing. And given that, you've got a large software base, a lot of existing host interfaces, I think there's a large argument that can be made for running TCP and IP directly on top of ATM. Even if you had a ubiquitous ATM structure, you could just run that and have compatibility for all your applications and all these other facilities that are out there right now. And it's not clear to me what you're trying to optimize if you get rid of IP. There are people who will argue that TCP is not going to be the protocol that take us into the gigabits. I think a lot of people have said that TCP/IP was not the protocol that would work well on Ethernet. And there are people who said TCP/IP is not a protocol that would work well on FIDI. And that there are, and now people are saying TCP/IP is not a protocol that will work well at very high data rate.
Well, I think the benchmarks and work done by David Borman at Cray kind of proves that It may not be the optimal protocol for gigabits, but it will certainly work.
Right. And the other thing, too, is, you know, we're not talking about a static target. You have options, header extension options, and other kind of things which are in place for TCP, and people are also working on things. So it's not the same TCP that we had back in 1980 that's running at gigabits. You know, you've got bigger window sizes and things like that in there. And so there's a capability there for evolving the standard, which we do all the time in the internet. And so I have a, you know, again, the question is, what do you gain? If you look at, you know, where the cycles are spent, it's typically not in TCP and IP. You've got a lot of other problems to deal with when you're operating at gigabit speed. So, you know, the question there is, you know, why would you want to do that? Maybe multimedia conferencing, et cetera, some of these applications may not be well suited or running on top of IP, maybe better suited to running on top of an ATM network directly.
Oh, sure. Audio, for example, could never run over the internet.
Could never run on top of something like IP. There's a lot of different ways that you could solve some of these problems. I think one of my concerns, as someone who's looking towards actually building an ATM wide area system and using it, is that I think a lot of people are overhyping ATM, especially some of the LAN vendors, who are purporting that ATM will cure baldness and, you know, it's a dessert topping, it's a floor wax, it does everything. And I guess my concern is, you know, as with all network technology, that it be used where it makes sense and that it not be sold into environments where it's not the right answer.
Does it make sense as a LAN interconnect for high-speed workstations?
I think it does. I think there's a lot of cases where it makes sense for that. Now, there's a lot of environments where Ethernet's a perfectly good solution, and you don't really need very high-speed requirements, performance requirements, because the workstation's I.O. architecture can't support good I.O. out at very high data rates anyway. And if you're looking at a physical plant that's limited to 10 base T type of wiring, the type 5 wiring plant or something, you might get 155 out of it. But, you know, you've got FDDI and other things there. I think it's good at doing a certain set of things, but we need to look at it from the point of, I mean, there's a paradigm shift in involved when you're talking about ATM. You're talking about switching rather than a LAN technology. And the ability of a LAN or of a network to be useful, you have to have operations and management capabilities as well. And with ATM, you just can't butt a LANalyzer into the LAN and see all the traffic that's going across it, right? By definition, it's being switched from, there's not a central spot where you can just tap into it like you can with FDDI or Ethernet. So it's important that's a negative argument against using that type of technology in LANs, because how many times when you are having a problem do you resort just to putting something out on the network in promiscuous mode and looking at all the packets? If you didn't have that tool available to you, you got yourself potentially some problems. Now, that has to be weighed against the advantages that ATM switching gives you, and I think potential advantages in an integrated local area, wide area environment. And so, again, you have to look at the cost-benefit trade-offs. But it's not a simple calculation. And I think people, in general, a lot of decisions that I think sort of market droids try and push are decisions that the customers really have to take a good solid look at, not just in terms of acquisition cost, not just in terms of raw performance, but in terms of operations and maintenance and the ability to support the thing and adapters that work at high performance. We're only now starting to see adapters for things like workstations that actually operate at reasonable data rates, because before they were doing the segmentation and reassembly in software. And you're burning your workstation CPU just trying to put the cells together and split them apart.
You're listening to Geek of the Week. Support for this program is provided by Sun Microsystems. Sun Microsystems, open systems for open minds. Additional support for Geek of the Week comes from O'Reilly & Associates, publishers of books that help people get more out of computers.